yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found, whose crimes have gone unpunished now, walk the streets a screaming now. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, let's talk about the news of the week. First of all, I want to say a few things about Trump's national emergency. Right? Big news. In terms of the media, the mainstream media, New York Times and so forth, you know, big spreads on the national emergency, front page stuff, like it's a big surprise. Well, go back to my blog of January 7th. I predicted that's what he was going to do, that all this negotiation and then his retreat, apparent retreat from the shutdown, was all staging of what he really wants to do, that is to declare a national emergency, which will enable him to move money and spend it differently than it was authorized to be spent by the Congress. You know, the U.S. Constitution is very clear. The Constitution says that the House of Representatives is responsible for raising money and spending. It shares that responsibility with the Senate, but it originates in the House, has to originate in the House, and only the House and Senate agreeing in their meetings following the House bills that have to originate in the House. That's what the money amount has to be spent on, when and where. That's the Constitution, very clear. Ah, but Trump is now going to dictate. If he declares a national emergency, what he's in a sense saying is that it doesn't matter what the national legislature, the Congress, decides. I'm going to change it. I'm going to spend it where I want. You know, up to now, presidents could slow the spending. Richard Nixon impounded the funds for the spending. But he couldn't shift the spending from that which was identified by Congress. He couldn't move it from one pot to the other and say, you know, I want to spend this on something that Congress shot down. No, but now Trump will be able to do that. National emergency. One step further towards executive presidential dictatorship. Well, it's a small step, but it's an important precedent here. Right. What he's going to do when he declares it, he's going to move it out of the Defense Department and defense funds, which are really bloated. And then he'll just, in his new budget, get Congress to put it back in the defense budget. And, of course, they're going to do that. Congress never backs off of proposals for raising defense spending. And this has been his plan all along, pretty clear. He's outmaneuvered the Democrats again. And by the way, talking about Democrats and national emergency, is it illegal for him to do that? Well, no, it's not. It's not illegal. In fact, the Democrats gave the president authorities way back in the 70s to do just that. And then there have been all kinds of test cases, legal test cases, where the Democrats allowed it to happen. So there's a lot of precedent here. And the Democrats are complicit in giving him the authority to do what he's doing. Yeah, he has the authority. He has the legal authority to do it. Is it a violation of the Constitution? Yes, it is. Well, can laws violate the Constitution? Not really. But it takes a Supreme Court to declare that. And will they? Well, it's going to get tied up in the courts for a long time. And who owns the Supreme Court? Well, Donald Trump owns the Supreme Court now. Right? He's got a clear majority on the Supreme Court. He'll get what he wants, and he knows it, and that's an incentive for him to go ahead and declare a national emergency because he knows he's going to win it if it ever gets to the Supreme Court. But it all represents a continuation of this drift towards a further limitation on democracy, democratic procedures and processes and institutions in the United States. That's been going on here for several decades now, which in my new book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, I have several chapters to show that these neoliberal economic policies are driving these political institutional changes and changes in ideology and changes in public opinion and so forth. It's a direct consequence. You know, the causal mechanisms are not always clearly understood, but it's clear. We have a decline of democracy and democratic practices in this country, and they are primarily due to enabling these new aggressive economic policies that Trump is developing. Talk about economic policies here. Trump is asking, or not asking, he's changing some rules, again, bypassing legislation, changing rules that will give businesses another $700 million in tax cuts, $700 million more, quietly, you know. It's obvious. It's not so obvious. The press is barely covering it, right? And the federal tax revenues are in decline as a result by hundreds of billions of dollars. Hundreds of billions because of the Trump tax cuts. Yeah, and then there's this other little piece, talk about tax cuts, that has popped up. And that is, all of a sudden, households are discovering that their refunds are down minus 8.7% this year. All of a sudden, whoa, wait a minute, didn't we get a tax cut last year? Yes, but as I've been saying in my analysis of the Trump tax cut, they clearly avoided front-loading the tax hikes on the middle class. They front-loaded the tax cuts for business and investors last year, first year of the Trump tax cuts, and they carefully avoided the hit to the middle class. Well, the hit's coming this year, right? Well, why did they do that last year? Well, because it was midterm elections. That's why. They went easy. And in fact, they gave people payroll deduction a little taste there, reduced their payroll deductions. So, they look like the middle class. You know, also got a tax cut last year. Well, that's over. And the tax hikes are coming. As I've been saying, $4.5 trillion in tax cuts under the Trump tax bill for investors, the wealthiest 1%, especially the 1/10 of 1%, and corporations and non-corporate businesses and multinational companies offshore. All big, $4.5 trillion over 10 years, and over 9 years, the last 9 years of that, not last year, but starting this year, hike in middle-class taxes of $2 trillion. And the real whack to middle-class tax hikes comes about 2024, you see, right after that election. Big, big hikes coming. They're going to take away everything, and some, from the middle class, $2 trillion. And then phony assumptions of U.S. economic growth for the next 10 years with no recession gives you the official $1.5 trillion hit of the Trump tax cuts, which is really $4.5 trillion. And the bigger cuts come for U.S. multinational corporations because now they don't have to pay anything on offshore taxes. Yeah, foreign profits tax, gone. Well, they weren't enforcing it anyway, but corporations can move their money offshore as they do with inversions and other tricks, and they won't have to pay taxes on it. And the trillions of dollars they have offshore, about $4 trillion, they can now bring back at a 10% tax rate or less instead of the former 35%. which, of course, has been reduced to 2025. Okay, so big tax cuts. How much have the foreign U.S. multinational corporations brought back so far? Officially, Fortune 500 only, about $500 billion. That's just the Fortune 500. You see, they don't talk about all the others. So maybe $1 trillion or $700, $800 billion total, bringing back that they'll pay taxes on at 10% at most. About half of that is even nothing. So let's say about 5% or 6% instead of 25%. So 20% of $700, $800 billion is about $1.5 trillion. It's over $1 trillion, isn't it? We're pretty damn close, right? Just in 1 year, multinational corporations, by bringing back $700 billion, paying 5%, 6%, 7% on it instead of 25% that the formal rule, if you're doing business in the U.S., says they must pay, before loopholes, of course, you know. Wow, they're the big benefactors of this, multinational corporations. You know, the tech companies, the big pharma companies, the big banks, you know, oil companies, they're the ones that have been given this big subsidy. See, the U.S. subsidizes business through the tax laws primarily. You know, big corporations get big checks written by the IRS. They don't pay. They get a check back, you see. They get big refunds. Some of them don't pay anything because of this various rules like five-year forward and backward averaging and so forth. Big subsidies. U.S. subsidizes big business tremendously. And yet we hear them, the U.S., complaining about China subsidizing its state-owned enterprises. You know, that's one of the demands of the U.S. trade negotiating team to China. Stop subsidizing your state-owned enterprises. Oh, your costs are too low, China, in your state-owned enterprises, and therefore their prices are too low, and they're undercutting U.S. corporations in competition. So you got to become less competitive, China. Stop your subsidies. Well, the U.S. subsidizes in hundreds of billions of dollars a year its multinationals. Yeah. Oh, you know, in economic jargon, it's like saying to the Chinese, hey, you're too efficient, right? State-owned enterprises, not market. Too efficient? Yeah, you produce too cheaply. We call that in economics productive efficiency, right? Lowest cost. Lower your prices for consumers too much. In other words, they can buy more at less. Economists call that allocative efficiency. Yeah, the Chinese state-owned enterprises are more efficient. Therefore, China has to privatize them and let private interests buy them, or stop subsidizing them. Oh, that fits very nicely with the other U.S. demand on China to give U.S. corporations 51% ownership or more, 100%. That's part of the trade deal, you know. 51% majority ownership, which allows banks to make big fees in these acquisitions. U.S. banks, I'm talking about. 51% ownership. Stop subsidizing your state-owned enterprises. Thirdly, buy more from the U.S. Well, the Chinese have already said in negotiations, we'll buy $1 trillion more of your farm goods. And then just this past week, they said, we'll buy a lot more of your microchips. In other words, they're willing to reverse the trade deficit. But you see, this fight in China is not about trade or trade deficits. No. This fight is about technology, as I've been saying over and over again. The Chinese have already conceded massively on ownership, on trade deficit, and now they're trying to get them to privatize their industries, the U.S. demand. But the big stickler is going to be the technology, and that's where it's stuck. You know, we got like a trade blackout here, trade negotiations blackout. We really don't know what's going on with the negotiations. You know, the trade ambassador for the U.S., Lighthizer, Robert Lighthizer, is over there now, and at his elbow is Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary. Well, Steve Mnuchin represents the big bankers who like the 51% interest, 51% ownership. He's there to make sure to watch over Lighthizer to see that he doesn't scuttle that nice big plum for you as bankers. Of course, Lighthizer is aligned with the Pentagon and the military-industrial complex, and they're concerned about the new technologies and their military implications. So the U.S. wants to stop China developing. And the U.S., you know, is going after Chinese companies in the meantime, Huawei and others, and getting its allies, Canada and Europe and Australia and others, to back it up and, prevent Huawei, which is a big telecom company and 5G technology leader, from getting a foothold. You know, including, you know, Pompeo's over there in Eastern Europe, and he's doing the same, you know. He's doing the same because the Chinese were making some inroads in Eastern Europe. Oh, no. Huawei included. No, let's keep Huawei out of this thing. You know? So, there's this big trade tech war going on between the U.S. and China. And all the rest of the tech stuff is insignificant, you know, insignificant. As you see in some of these deals that already have emerged here. Okay, so Trump's national emergency. I predicted back in January 7th he'd declare it, and now he is. It's a violation of the Constitution. The Democrats have enabled it significantly. You know, what if the Democrats were in power? You think they would declare a national emergency to do something about health care and impose single-payer Medicare for all or something? Or do something about housing crisis or do something about nationalizing the banks in the next financial crash coming? No, they won't do it. Especially the corporate Democrats, who are getting worried now about the left wing in their party, you know. Ocasio and some of the others are beginning to take a lead on new ideas, and corporate Democrats, Pelosi and us, don't want to change it. They don't want to do anything about that. Right? So, we'll see what the Dems do now that he's declaring national emergency. Yeah, it'll just be tied up in courts, and then it'll get to Trump's Supreme Court, and that'll be the end of it sometime after the next elections. All right, the other thing I want to talk about is to my friends out there in New York City who have managed to drive Amazon out of the town. Hey, three cheers for you. Good job. Yeah. Look, you know, New York City had to pay officially $3 billion to attract the wealthiest company, Amazon, in terms of, valuation, Amazon, to come to New York. It's going to be $5 billion, not $3 billion. For what? 25,000 jobs, they said. 25,000 jobs at $100,000 average each. That was the estimate. 25,000 at $100,000 plus. $100,000 jobs, those are tech R&D jobs, you see. And where are they going to get those folks? Oh, they're going to relocate to New York. And they're going to relocate as close as possible to that area in New York where Amazon was going to start its operations. And you know what that would have meant? Gentrification. Yeah, and the folks that live in that area would have been driven out. Hey, that's not a theory or a prediction. That's exactly what's happened with tech in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. San Francisco in particular, the boom in tech in Silicon Valley, all the 20-somethings, you know, engineers and so forth, Silicon Valley's boring as hell, just a bedroom community. So they all want to locate and have located to San Francisco, where the action is for young folks. All right, and they've driven up the prices in San Francisco astronomically. Astronomically. You know what it costs to live in San Francisco on average? On average, about $120,000 a year to afford housing and other costs in San Francisco now. San Francisco used to be a great city, you know, with neighborhoods, working class neighborhoods, ethnic neighborhoods. You know, it was very diverse, as they say, and it was a great city in many ways. But now it's being totally gentrified, totally. And all the folks who used to live there, working class folks, you know, Latino folks and gays and so forth, being driven out. African-Americans, they're being driven out, have been driven out. And you go to San Francisco in the morning and you see these big buses, you know, driving through these neighborhoods, these big buses, picking up the techies, clogging up the neighborhoods, and picking up the techies to take them down to Silicon Valley. Yeah. And, you know, a small one-bedroom or studio apartment in San Francisco will cost you $1 million. Yeah, $1 million. Incredible. Well, that's how tech has ruined San Francisco and the problem spilling over elsewhere in the Bay Area. Well, that's what's going to happen to New York if Amazon locates there, at least to that neighborhood in New York, and the folks there know it. And why are you paying $3 billion, or $5 billion, really, for 25,000 $100,000 tech jobs, when, if the government really wanted to, you know, for $3 or $5 billion, it could create 60,000, for $3 billion, it could take 60,000 jobs instead of 25 at $50,000 each. $50,000 jobs in New York. If the government spent that money itself instead of giving it to Amazon. So gentrification, housing costs, job creation, efficiency, you don't get much for bang for your buck. That was what Amazon was going to bring to New York. And three cheers for New Yorkers for driving them out. Of course, the corporate Democrats in New York and the state of New York, you know, are just sort of fuming now, all right? And all the speculators, the financial speculators, are very disappointed that they're not going to be able to pull off all this speculation that they were going to get or be able to get here and make themselves a pot of money on this move to New York, right? They're not going to be able to get it now. Oh, too bad. Driving up the prices and driving folks out of their neighborhoods. Yeah, that's Amazon New York. Now, we're talking about Amazon, and as I've said before, you know, Amazon is really a tech company. It's not a warehouse company. It's a high-tech company. Amazon's biggest revenue driver in the company, you know, is not shipping boxes around, right? It's cloud computing for the U.S. government, right? Its servers, its cloud servers are the big money maker, right? And it's really driving into the tech side of technology side of business, you know, with, you know, it's Alexa. That's a simple bot, you know, a simple a retail bot. But it really sees the future in enterprise scale Alexas, and I was selling to business. It's a leader in technology. It's right up there with Google, Alphabet, you know, Facebook, and all the rest. And I've been talking, in, you know, on my blog, jackrasmus.com, there are articles about that, you know, Amazon the Job Killer. Go check it out, right? Because even though it hires jobs initially in its warehouses, it's going to eliminate jobs. Its whole plan is to eliminate those jobs in the warehouses. And it's well on its way of doing that in the next few years. But AI is at the heart of a lot of this and these changes, AI. And there was an article today, or yesterday, I forget which, in the Financial Times that people should note, pay some attention to, that had to do with AI, right? And in this case, it wasn't Amazon. It was Elon Musk's and his empire, another tech giant here, right? Artificial intelligence, a category of artificial intelligence, is called deep learning. Deep learning. And this is text analysis, right? Using AI and massive computing power in databases in order to analyze text, written, printed word, right? And spoken word as well. Now, what AI was doing, or what Musk was doing and his subsidiary, OpenAI, it was called, OpenAI, was to create what's called automatic text generation. In other words, by analyzing text, predict what could be said based upon what was already analyzed and saying it. Right. Now, what that means, you know, this was a language system called GPT-2 that Musk's OpenAI division had developed very secretly, you know. Now, think about it, right? OpenAI, deep learning, text generation. Well, you could create whatever stories you wanted almost instantaneously. And that's what this would do. Fake news, anybody? Yes. Machine learning driven news creation? Yes. Ideology? Yes. Confuse the public and keep the facts from the public, you know, swamp them with all this machine generated stories and fake news? Yes. Talk about fake news, right? Fake news on demand. Yeah. Well, even Musk saw the negative potential of this, and big news in Financial Times here today, he's pulled back the research on this, right? Yeah. You know, just think the consequences of what could be done to confuse the public and lie to the public instantaneously and massively. You wouldn't know what are the facts, what's the reality. And, of course, another example how AI will destroy jobs, right? Deep learning will destroy jobs. All you reporters out there, watch out. They don't need you. Get rid of you and generate. You generate not only audio, fake audio stories and news, but soon they'll be able to generate fake video to accompany it. You know, we'll get all these holograms or whatever of reporters in your local news out there, and no one will be out there, but they'll be reporting it, and you'll think they're real people, but they're not. You'll think this is real news, but it's not. Shades of George Orwell. Okay. I just think that's, you know, something to keep your eye on and watch these companies, you know, the Amazons, the Googles, the Alphabets, the Open AI and all of this. Watch it. Now, next 10 years. Really dangerous stuff, I think, for the culture and the political system going forward. Okay. So good for you, New Yorkers. Yeah, throw those SOBs out. Right. They're only going to take your money and then destroy your neighborhoods and drive you out of your neighborhoods because you won't be able to afford to live there. All right, let's talk about another piece of information here on the U.S. economy. You know, I've been predicting for a long time here, that recession late 2019 in the U.S. And, of course, the statistics hype last year about GDP, 3%, 2.5% or more, right? Yeah, that's been going on for some time. But I've been challenging those numbers. You know, the numbers are really the result of subsidies, corporations, temporary subsidies. You know, third quarter U.S. GDP is 3.4%. Fourth quarter estimate is going to be 2.3%. But most of that occurred in October, early November. November, December was very poor in the economy. And some estimates are that the first quarter of this year, U.S. GDP will only be 1.6%, or even as low as 1%. Now, you got to remember that all these figures that I just cited are puffed up by redefinitions of what GDP is back in the Obama period, which added about 0.3%. Using estimations of the value of corporate logos and R&D and intellectual property for which there's no real prices, but, you know, just giving it, assigning it a price, adding it to GDP, about 0.3%, about $500 billion a year in the U.S. GDP is redefinition. So, you know, all of these figures, you know, first quarter is at 1% low end forecast. Well, it's really 0.7%, virtually flat. All right, we'll see what it's going to be. Of course, they'll probably, if it slows down dramatically, they'll blame it on the shutdown. And they'll blame it on, the shutdown meant we couldn't get good statistics. You know, they'll find some other way of avoiding the facts. But I've been predicting a significant lower number for U.S. GDP in the first quarter of this year. We'll see. But that's being confirmed by the recent report on retail sales. You know, consumption is 70% of the economy, and retail sales are the majority of consumption. Well, for December, retail sales were down a negative 1.2%. U.S. retail sales fell negative 1.2% during the holiday, when you think retail sales would boost. Now, that negative 1.2% is the worst drop since 2009 recession, right? That's when we were in recession. Negative 1.2% drop in retail sales in December. What's it going to be for January, February? We don't know. We'll see. Right? And, you know, it's got economists and politicians perplexed. They can't understand, you know, why, if we're getting all these jobs creation and therefore income, that we've got a big decline. You know, rising income should boost retail and sales and consumption, but it didn't. Well, you know, either the numbers for the retail sales are wrong, or the numbers for the job creation are wrong. Because when you have more jobs, there's more income, and people, you know, spend more, and therefore sales should go up. Maybe there aren't as many of those jobs. You know, I've been saying all along that I think these job numbers are incorrect. Why? I think what they're doing is picking up a lot of second and third part-time jobs and believing that that's employment, actually new hires. Well, you get inflated job numbers if the job creation is a lot of part-time second and third jobs. And I think that's what's happening. You know, the government calculates or estimates jobs that have been offered, not whether it's a new first-time employment for that job that's been offered. Yeah. Oh, that's why we got another problem is we got 7 million job openings that aren't being filled. Oh, that's supposed to represent a robust job market. Well, those are mostly high-end, high-paid, yes, high-end skilled tech-trained jobs that we can't fill because we don't train people for the new jobs in the new industries anymore. Well, that's okay, you know. We'll just bring in some foreign software engineers to take these jobs, which is what we're doing. It's called H-1B visas, right? During his election, Trump promised to do something about that. Well, he's recently issued rules that, you know, totally back off of that. Yeah, I'll say, so retail sales, watch out. And also a supporting indicator of that is the producer price index, which also came in negative. Negative 0.1%, meaning deflation. Well, you get deflation when you've got a slow economy. Once again, well, is it really growing at 2.3 or 3.4% if you get deflation in producer prices? Well, we'll see. And it couldn't have been oil prices because oil prices were rising in the fourth quarter. But autos are tanking. We know that. The auto industry. Okay. And then household debt, you know, is rising. I talked about that. And then we have, as I've written in an article, jackrasmus.com on my blog, we have and or talked about on my tweet at drjackrasmus, an advisory committee to the U.S. Treasury, to Mnuchin, has warned the Treasury that under Trump for the next 8 years or 6 years, we're going to have an additional $12 trillion in bond buying that the Treasury and the Fed are going to have to do to finance the Trump deficits, now at $1 trillion for as long as the far as the eye can see, going to have to sell $12 trillion more in bonds to finance it. Going to have to sell. Well, next week, the Fed auction is auctioning, what, $110 billion in 1 week? $110 billion in 1 week. Oh, but there's a problem here because if the Fed doesn't keep raising rates and attract buyers, it might not be able to sell that. But the Fed, as we've talked about, has already been forced to back down because of the stock market crash, 30% decline last year. So the Fed's backed off of that. Yeah. Oh, but the Fed doesn't drive its policy based upon financial markets, right? Only the real economy. BS. Right. This retreat, this halt and Fed rates is really in response to pressures, not just by Trump, but by the banking and finance and investor industries to stop raising interest rates, stop raising the benchmark federal funds rate, which is now at about 2.5%, because doing so is causing paroxysms in the stock markets. So the Fed has stopped at 2.5%, which means it has very little ammunition in the next recession coming soon to lower rates. Very little. I predicted that was going to happen in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes, you know, which appeared in August 2017, and subsequent articles I wrote about central bankers and the problems with the shift to the Fed policy. That's on my website in the European Financial Review and World Financial Review. Following the production of my book, publication of it, I wrote several articles summarizing some of this. And my next article appearing in the European Financial Review next month, March, April, is Trump versus the Fed. How independent really are central banks? Where I pretty much argue that It's not the presidents and Congress that drive strategic directions in the Fed. It's the bankers and the private sector themselves that drive it behind the scenes. I'll talk about behind the scenes and the revolving door between Fed governors and the banking industry. You know, recently, you know, the former vice chair, Stanley Fischer of the Fed, took up a job with the biggest asset management shadow bank firm, BlackRock. Yeah. He's just the latest in the revolving doors between the Fed and the banking industry. You know, these governors are appointed for 7-14 years, and they don't stay there more than 3 or 4 or less. You know, once they're on the Fed, they go get a nice offer and go into the banks, just like Stanley Fischer just did. And guys like Ben Bernanke, you know, former chair, what he does, he's been doing, he's aligned. He's a director now for a lot of banks and corporations. And they invite him to their banking conventions and pay him $200,000 plus for a 15-minute speech. Oh, yes, we pay off our bureaucrat functionaries very well, you see, and that's not corruption, right? It's all legal. Yes, that's the way they do it. After the fact, if you deliver nicely, we'll give you a nice job. You deliver for us, you know, politician, you know, head of the finance committee in the Senate, or, you know, former chair or vice chair of the central bank, you know. We're not going to tell you what to do in the interim, but, you know, there's a nice pot of money at the end of it if you do right. And they do right, and then they go into business. Right. Good luck, Stanley. You really need the money, I'm sure. Okay. The Fed has given up. The Fed has thrown in the towel. And the news also this past week is the Fed now clearly has given up on what's called quantitative tightening. You know, quantitative easing was when it gave all that free money, $4.5 to $6 trillion in free money, including the rollovers, to banks and investors and shadow bankers and so forth during the crisis. And now, supposedly last 2 years, it was going to take some of that money back. That's called quantitative tightening, or QT. Well, I predicted it's not going to be able to take much back. And now the Fed, big headline here in today's Wall Street Journal, Fed nears plan to end asset wind down, i.e. to end QE. Yeah. So it's halting rates, and it's halting, trying to pull back that massive liquidity it injected. It's halting all of that. The Fed's given up, thrown in the towel. And now it has very little ammunition for the next crisis. Well, if you look at Europe and Japan, they even have less ammunition. They were supposed to follow the Fed and the Bank of England in raising rates here, as the Fed did in 2017 and 18, supposed to follow them, and reluctantly was beginning to consider to do so. European Central Bank was supposed to raise rates later this year. It won't now, obviously, because Europe is as much on a brink of a recession that you could say a brink is. Italy's in recession. Clearly, Germany now, 1/4 here, has slipped into recession, minus 0.2% GDP. France, we've got their manufacturing and other PMIs less than 50, which means contraction. We got the UK slowing rapidly as it approaches its Brexit date here. Europe's in a funk economically. Forget Europe, right? And the central bank won't be able to raise rates, and it won't end its QE. It reduced it a little bit, but it won't end it now. Well, what about the Bank of Japan, BOJ? Huh. Well, they're not even beginning to suggest that they're going to end their QE. And, you know, and their QE not only subsidizes government and corporate bonds, it subsidizes their stock market. Yeah, their central bank buys stock, increases the demand for stock, keeps the price up, and keeps the shareholders happy. Talk about subsidizing investors. You know, hypocritical to say the Chinese are subsidizing. Well, the West subsidizes and taxes, tax and monetary policy, fiscal policy, whatever. Big subsidization. Just does it differently, that's all. And then, you know, households here up to their elbows in debt, well, approaching $14 trillion, rising, growing problems with subprime and other auto loans. We got, I think, the default rate's now 9% and rising in the auto loans. People just 90 days or more overdue in their payments, their auto payments, rising rapidly. And then student loans, you know, $1.5 trillion in student loans and default rates, much higher than being reported. You know, they just take some of the defaults and say, oh, we're going to put them in a special category. They're not really defaults, and therefore we report a lower default rate to the media and the press to hide it. You know, but defaults are rising significantly in both auto loans and in student debt payments. And now the tax refunds are going to be less, down 8.7% already. Okay, so where's the consumption going to come from? You know, people up to their elbows in debt, households, and getting less tax refunds now. Well, this retail sales thing is probably going to continue to slow. And when that happens, the stock market is going to recognize that, oop, we're closer to a recession, if not already in one, and it's going to pull back. You know, we've had two dead cat bounces in the stock market. February in 2018 dropped thousands of points a day, and then a bigger 30% drop in the stocks November, December, a recovery here in January. But it's, as I've been saying, that's a bull market, fake bull market recovery in what is a long-term bear market. And we're going to see another big stock market drop this year, maybe even bigger than last November. We even got guys like Krugman admitting now that the U.S. recession may be on the horizon. And, you know, Paul has even said later this year or 2020. Well, that's my forecast of over a year ago. Well, glad to have you on board, Paul. A high probability, greater than 50-50, that there will be a recession later this year. Of course, he's given that quote in a speech way off in Dubai. You know, maybe he thought it wouldn't hit here, but it has, and it's being reported now. Right? And central banks are throwing in the towel on the eve of all this. And we got a massive $22 trillion government debt going up another $12 trillion. And the Fed can't do anything about it. Right? And Trump is talking about more tax cuts to do something about it. Even more. You know, hundreds of billions of dollars. We got a trillion-dollar deficit rising, largely because of the tax cuts, hundreds of billions of dollars, particularly corporate taxes and investor taxes. That's where it's all hitting. Government revenues way down, tax revenues way down, in a boom period, so-called, you know. Questions whether we're in a boom period as a result, you know. And the Fed can't do anything about it, and they want more tax cuts and more deficits, in other words, and he's going to spend more on defense, right? QT is halted. Rate hikes are halted. Euro area is in virtual recession here with negative interest rates. They can't lower it. Japan, two of the four quarters in 2018 were negative, in other words, recession quarters. And the only reason you got a positive third quarter in Japan, GDP, is because of there were natural disasters and quick spending, you know, to offset it. But you'll see Japan weakening again, fundamentally, in 2019 as well. And, of course, China's slowing down. And we'll see what happens to that economy. So, Germany down 0.2%, as I said, Italy in recession. Eurozone overall down, only growing at 0.2%. In other words, virtually flat, statistically flat. And then we have this Brexit vote, the second vote over there. Theresa May, Prime Minister, had a second vote here yesterday or day before, about her policy. She's trying desperately to compromise with the European Union, which won't give her any slack, you see. European Union wants to punish Britain for leaving because it believes if it gives terms that are too soft for Britain to leave the EU, that will simply encourage other members of the EU to do the same. And yes, it will. So they're being hard-nosed with Britain. Britain's got to pay like $60 billion and can't really leave, even if it leaves under the agreement, for 18 months. And Britain has to leave the door open in Northern Ireland and Ireland, because the EU is protecting its member Ireland. There was no borders between Northern Ireland and Ireland, which is just a back door for remaining in the EU, even if they leave under the agreement negotiated by Theresa May and the EU. And, of course, the British Parliament said, this stinks, and they shot it down by 200 votes, 200 margin back in January. And they had this other vote here trying to do, you know, to vote on some technicalities, and still lost by 45 votes in the Parliament. And the fact that Theresa May cannot get a deal in her own parliament simply communicates, sends a message to the EU that, oh, don't sweeten the deal to help Theresa because she can't get it passed anyway. So they're holding off. In other words, they're caught between a rock and a hard place. What are they going to do? Well, Brexit, March 29th, they'll kick the can down the road again. They'll extend it. Yeah, that's my prediction. They'll extend it, and they'll have to get rid of Theresa May and have another prime minister to be able to negotiate a deal with the EU. So that's my prediction with Brexit. It always has been. They'll kick it down the road, and, national British capitalists, their strategy has always been delay, 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 have a second referendum. And that's where they're headed, you see. That's what they've always planned to do. But the British economy is going to get weaker, and so is the EU economy, so that's a wild card. Who knows what's going to happen there? We'll see. So my prediction, Brexit, kick the can down the road. No hard Brexit on March 29th. Just as I predicted, no shutdown. No new shutdown of the government by Trump. That was all a tactical move on his part. And just as I predicted and continue to predict that the U.S.-China trade negotiations, which come to a deadline March 1st, will be extended. We're already getting tweets from Trump to that effect. It'll be extended. They'll keep negotiating. It'll take probably to the summer to hash out a deal with China. And I believe that the deal with China... China's already conceded on two major areas, you know, the trade deficit. They're going to buy $1 trillion more and 51% or more ownership. The big stickler is tech, and that's what Lighthizer and the Pentagon really want. I think they'll get some language on that. the Chinese will be clever in agreeing to some language that will allow Trump to come back and say, see, I got them to slow down on this tech stuff. But the Chinese will find another way to continue it. They really won't stop their tech development. And their whole future depends on it, as it does for the U.S. You know, who files all the patents in the world on new technologies? It's the U.S. It's the U.S. and China. Everyone else is far behind. Maybe the Germans way down there, you know. It's a tech war, new industries war for the next generation. Okay. All right, so my predictions continue. You know, go back to December on this show, my December show, December 28th, I think it was, where I made my economic and political predictions. Maybe I'll write a print piece and post it on my blog to that effect. Read my, if you're interested, my latest post on my blog on the national emergency and the shutdown and what that all means. And it includes my comments on what's going on in Venezuela. What's the strategy in Venezuela? Well, to get Brazil and the other right-wing radical regimes now to set up shop in Colombia on the border and provide humanitarian aid, you see. That's what the whole thing is, humanitarian aid. Well, that's just a way of sucking over the border provinces into the Trump camp, you know, this guy Guaido, you know, he's their puppet, establish a relationship with the Venezuelans on that border, and then cross the border militarily if they need to. And it won't be U.S. troops. It'll be Brazilian, another OAS right-wing, Chilean and Argentinian troops, right? Then you got a civil war. In the meantime, the U.S. is just ripping off assets from Venezuela. You know, it stole Citgo, the oil company, and the money it Citgo generates is going to give to Guaido and his right-wingers, see? So the U.S. continues tightening the noose on Venezuela, and we'll see what happens there. Okay, that's it for today. Jack Rasmussen, Alternative Visions, next week.